Welcome to Book Friends Forever, the questions from the SCBWI Summer Spectacular episode. Every week we catch up with each other's lives, talk about what's on our minds, and share with each other what we're grateful for.
And if you enjoy our podcast, please tell a friend about it. And check out our website, bookfriendsforever.com. The website will include more detailed show notes, as well as links to the episodes.
And please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps with discoverability. So thank you everyone who has already rated and reviewed our podcast. So today we're posting the Q&A section of Grace and my keynote session from the SCBWI Summer Spectacular. But we thought we'd record our usual catching up with each other's lives. And just as a note, we are recording this on Saturday, August 8th.
So Alvina, how have you been?
Well, I've been busy with SCBWI. In addition to the keynote we did, I'm doing some critiques that I actually just finished. So I did them Friday and Saturday, but I had to prepare for them in advance. And that was done all via phone, you know, just via the phone. And I sent them the critiques in advance. I also participated in the Farrelly Dickinson Masters. I just did some like one-on-ones versus on Zoom, like 15-minute one-on-ones with students.
Wait, what is Farrelly Dickinson?
They have a master's. So Donna, who I've mentioned before, Donna Freitas, she is one of the instructors, I guess, for this master's program. And they, you know, it's adult, and they're a college or university in New Jersey. So she's been involved for quite a while. I think I've done other events with them. This year it's all virtual, of course, but it's like a, you know, to be honest, I don't know how it works. I think it's similar to Vermont College in that it's like a, you know, they go on campus for like maybe 2 weeks or maybe it's a week, and they, you know, they meet in person usually, and then they invite speakers like editors and probably agents and other authors. So this year it's all virtual. So I just agreed to do some, you know, like one-on-ones where they had the opportunity to ask me questions. You know, some of them chose to just ask me kind of process questions, ask advice about agents. Some of them chose to say, hey, can I pitch my book and can you let me know how the pitch sounds and if it works? You know, and some of them were adult authors, so they weren't pitching me necessarily. Mm-hmm. They were just kind of asking for advice. So it was interesting. Yeah, it's just, cool. You know, on top of, you know, my regular job, it just kind of added a lot. And then also, as you know, I'm planning to head up to Vermont tomorrow. So I've been packing for that, and I'm going, I think I'm saying like 2 months, like kind of, you know, while our offices are definitely not going to reopen, although I don't think they're going to be, honestly don't think our office will be reopening this year. So I might kind of be going back and forth for the rest of the year, but it's just really, I fell in love with Vermont and I want to go back. So so that's been busy.
So it's going to be a pretty extended stay. It's almost like you're going to have two homes now, maybe.
I know. And I'm bringing my cat. So aww. I've been little stressing about that. I, you know, took her to the vet, got a checkup. You know, she has some anti-anxiety medication, so
yeah, I think she'll like it. Adventure.
I think she'll so like too. It. You know, she just wants to be where I am. So
yeah. And now you're spending so much time with hers, but it's going to be exciting for you to be in Vermont. Do you think it's going to affect your work at all?
I don't think so. You know, because we can work from anywhere. I mean, I think it'll just be a little bit like a weird, maybe, but. But no, I mean, I don't think it shouldn't. We shall see.
Maybe you'll make it better.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe I'll be able to focus more. But how about you? How have you been?
Well, honestly, it's been a really tough week for me. I wish I could say it was like one big thing, but I feel like it's just a lot of little things, you know, and that seems so... Like, I guess when you take a step back, it seems so insignificant. But to me, it just felt like there were so many things going on. I actually kind of had like a little bit of a breakdown because I just felt like, oh, so much stuff. Like, so there, I guess two of the things, I mean, there's lots of little things, but I guess two of the major things that kind of like pushed me over the edge was, one was getting a printer. And that's what I mean. Like, it sounds so silly. And I'm even laughing at myself when I say that. Like, because I'm working, as you know, I'm working on this picture book for Little Brown. And I've done these sketches, and I've done the sketches very, very detailed. And I want it to be, I want the paintings to be really good. And so one of the things that I do is I print my sketches on watercolor paper so then I can paint over them. And in the past, it's worked beautifully, wonderfully, because I've always done horizontal books. But this mm-hmm. is the first time in a long time that I've done a vertical book. So so when I enlarge the sketch, my current printer isn't big enough to print it. So I need a bigger printer. And I did not want to purchase a bigger printer because it's expensive. And yep. and like, and that's not really what I want to spend my money on. But I did so much trying to not buy a printer. Like, I called every single printer place in town. I asked every friend who had a larger size printer to try it, and, you know, couldn't work. Like, I actually even ordered a printer that was more affordable than the expensive one, and, like, that was out of stock for, like, 2 weeks. It was like this ridiculous kind of rigmarole kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I was, like, driving myself crazy. And if I had just plunked down the money to get the correct expensive printer, I would have had a painting done by now, at least. But I finally had to just give in and pay the money, buy the expensive yeah. printer. But it was such an interesting thing because, like, I bought the printer. Like, I actually felt, like, physically sick, like, paying that money, right? And it yeah. was such a, it's such an interesting thing because, on the other hand, the other thing that's kind of pushing me over the edge is my daughter's schooling, right? So I think earlier I've talked on the podcast about, like, I'm trying to start, like, pods with families, right? And trying to figure out how to make it more inclusive. But it really doesn't look like it's gonna work out. Like, I haven't been able to make that much headway. I kind of think that my daughter's strength is also her weakness. She gets along with everyone, but she didn't have any, like, really close, like, besties, you know, like, best friends. And so it's not that, you know, I don't think anybody dislikes her or anything, but I think that when it comes to pods, you know, they already have, like, their best friend that they're gonna pod with. And I think also us as her parents weren't is helpful either because, you know, I've been gone so much traveling, so I don't really have any good friends with, like, really close friends with any of the fellow parents. And my husband, you know, was the main caretaker, and I think as a man, and also because of his personality, maybe mm-hmm. mostly because of his personality, he didn't really bond with a lot of the parents either. So we found it really hard to see if a pod in our future, you know, inclusive mm-hmm. or exclusive. And so we decided we're going to have to look into private schools, right? So which is a real, I feel appropriately guilty for even considering it, because I feel like, you know, it's such a, we talk about diversity and we talk about, like, inclusivity and stuff, but I just felt like, I just don't think we can offer her what she needs with our own homeschooling, especially if it's a repeat of what happened in the spring. So now we've been investigating. I've been talking to different private schools, you know, and they're really expensive. I mean, and maybe that's why the printer was, like,
right, was just more and more money.
Yeah, more yeah. and more money. And it's not that, like, we can't afford the printer, and, like, we can afford the private school, you know, but it's tight, you know, and it's tough, and it's also, like, it's just more and more, like, it just felt like I guess I just kept feeling like I'm getting squeezed and squeezed, and, like, and there's, like, no way out. Like, mm-hmm. I know in our questions and answers with the SCBWI, I remember during our talk, you quoting your mom, where she said, if it's to be, it's up to me. And I kind of felt like, oh, I feel that so much. Like, I feel like if we're going to get through this, if we're going to get her, my daughter, appropriate schooling, if I'm going to get anything done, it's really just up to me. Like, that's really how I felt. And I'm like, oh, you know, sometimes when it's up to me, it really sucks.
Yeah, you wish it could be up to someone else.
Like, why can't it be up to somebody else? like nobody, like that feeling that you realize, like, no one's going to save you. Like, and yeah, like, you really want someone to, like, save you, or just like, or just help, you know. But like, that's the problem with this pandemic. It just, like, all the places that you could lean on to help, and all the, like, the friends that I know would be happy to help, you know, like, you can't lean on them now. Like, and you can't even, I don't even feel right asking for them because it's not safe, you know. So all these things, like, I'm not going to ask my mother-in-law to come down and help watch my child, you know, like, it's just not safe. So so it's been a tough week.
It's a frustrating time for sure. Yeah. Complicated. Well, I'm sorry. Well, now at least the printer is going to be resolved.
Yes,
right?
At least the printer is going to be resolved.
I feel like that'll feel better. Yeah. To at least have one thing, like, just resolved.
Yeah. I just paid the money and we'll just go from there. And, like, yeah, I'm sure things will get better. And now on to the question and answer section of our SCBWI Summer Spectacular session. You'll hear Laurent Lin joining and moderating the questions for us. Laurent is the art director at Simon & Schuster for Young Readers, where he collaborates with both noted and new illustrators on picture books, middle grade, and teen novels. He is also an author himself. Look for his illustrated YA novel, Draw the Line. Here's the Q&A section of our SCBWI Summer Spectacular session.
So now we have curated some of your amazing questions. By the way, you are asking phenomenal questions. Unfortunately, we won't get to them all. However, we will try to get through as many as possible. So these are questions for both of you. I want to start with this one that Ginger asks. How do you stay friends and work so closely together? Is it ever tempting to be too soft or hard on each other because of your shared history? And I'll just expand that a bit because we are a community, and often we do, like a lot of illustrators who I have met at a conference at SCBWI and then have hired, and then you do form a kind of a friendship. So it really is, we all know each other. So how do you, but you really know each other. So so how do you temper that professionalism with the friendship?
Well, I have to say that before I worked with Alvina, I did not have an agent. And it was when we decided to work together, that's when I decided I should get an agent, because we kind of knew that the thing that would mess it up is talking about money. So the thing that is our kind of agreement is that we never talk about the money. That's through my agent, Rebecca and Alvina. They talk about the money, and I'm just like, I'm on the back end saying, yeah. and of course, talking to Rebecca privately and all those things. But so that leaves us a lot of freedom. So we only talk about creative things, and that gives us a lot of, a lot of safety, I guess, you know? And so that way we don't have to worry about the money being the thing, because money is such a loaded thing, you know? So as long as we keep that separate, that helps us a lot. Mm-hmm. At least in my opinion. I don't know. What do you think?
No, I agree with that. Well, actually, for Year of the Dog, you didn't have Rebecca yet, but I think that's why you got Rebecca, is because it was awkward. I mean, honestly, it was awkward for me to say, we are going to pay you this much money. And then Grace is like, can I have a little more? I don't know. It was just weird. So I am very glad that Grace has an agent now. But what I would say is, when we were roommates in Boston and when Grace was still publishing mainly with other publishers, I was kind of her first editor, because she would run ideas by me. She would, you know, I would read her manuscripts. So we kind of established that relationship but I think above all, trust. I think because we are such good friends, she knows that I have her best interests at heart, and vice versa. And so I feel like that's what is very important in the author editor relationship. I know every editor is different. And I actually really struggled with this of, should I be friends with colleagues? Should I be friends with the creators that I work with. And I just found myself becoming friends with them. And I would often say, like, well, if I love their writing or if I love their art, then I will also love them. And that has turned out to be the case. And so, like, my authors are my dear friends, you know. So that's how I've decided I'm comfortable working. And it probably did kind of stem from my relationship with Grace and then our working relationship.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, I think that, I was going to say, I just think that because we've known each other so long, I feel like that has what has made me a better writer and creator, because there's this feeling of trust, you know, like when she says something that is not like, well, I don't think that's very good. Like, I don't feel like, I don't take it like she thinks I'm terrible. She thinks I suck. She thinks I'm awful. I think, oh, she doesn't think that's working. You know, like, whereas maybe if it was somebody else, I would be like, oh my gosh, they think they're never going to hire me again. And they think I'm horrible, you know? So I think that's been really good for me, because I'm just wrought with insecurity.
You are, creative people share a lot in common like that, don't we? And the trust is wonderful to hear you both say that, because it is trust, and it's about, and what you're saying, Grace, it's about the work. It's not about you, it's about the work. And that's important that I hear you both say too. Another question from Andy is somewhere on planet Earth, we don't know where. To you, Alvina, is there any frequent note you find yourself giving writers on their work?
Interesting. Well, as mentioned with Grace, the frequent note was to, you know, to put her characters in peril and add more conflict. I wouldn't say there's a note that I give every author, because every author is different. I think what's been interesting is that when I've started to work with authors over multiple books, I do start seeing themes, but it's specific to that author. So, you know, like, one author might be, you know, really trying to suss out the theme of the book or what the book is about, because there's just weight, you know, so there are some authors who just kind of need reining in. Other authors need a lot of tightening and pacing work, organizational work. So every author is different, because every author has a different process. And I think their individual process leads to different issues that are often similar across books.
And that comes back to respect again, respect for that individual creator too, that you are so good at. another question from Jill, for both of you, I would say, when starting, because this is something, Alvina, you would guide or help an author with, and Grace, you've certainly been here. When starting a new novel, what are some techniques for discovering the right viewpoint, first versus third, present versus past?
Grace.
I would say, I write the first thing that comes to my head, and if it doesn't work, then I try another way. If it doesn't work, try another way. I don't really have a really good tip, except try them all and see which one works the best. Because to me, I feel like every story is different, and you're just not going to know until you try it. I think that was the advice that I was going to give. Like, the advice is, don't be afraid to play. And I think this was given to me by Linda C. Clark, who said, don't be afraid to play. Nobody has to read it. Like, and it's not wasted. Like, it's not, you're not wasting words if you try it one way and then try it another way and then try it a third way, you know? So my advice is, there's probably not a best way in terms of first person, third person. It depends on your story. And I would try whichever one comes naturally first. And if it isn't working, try the next one, and then try the next one until you got one that really feels right.
Yeah, and I do think that sometimes the type of story you're writing will dictate the narrator. So, for example, if you're writing a mystery, you might want the reader to know things that the main character doesn't know, for example. So in that case, you might want to do dual perspective, or you might want to do third person omniscient. Depending on the plot too, like, let's say you want it to be unknown. I guess this goes back to thriller mystery. Like, you want the reader to not know if the main character survives at the end, for example. If you're writing in first person, the reader can probably assume that the narrator is going to survive, unless your book is called I'm Gonna Die at the End, you know, but which there is a book like that. But yeah, so sometimes it is just really knowing your plot and and, you know, kind of what suits the story. But yes, sometimes you do have to try. And I've, you know, I've worked with authors where it's like, okay, try it in third person, try it in first person. And sometimes they've rewritten, because they've already completed the book, and they rewrite the whole thing, you know, and it is just kind of, you know, trial and error.
Mm-hmm. Another question touches on something you both spoke about, which is wanting to see stories that are about you or when you were a child and growing up, or seeing more diverse stories. And our Victoria asks, do you think more diversity in the upper echelon of the publication world will open up more opportunities for writers from marginalized communities? Do you see that happening soon? And Alvina, I know you started out, what was it like for you starting out as an Asian American editor? Probably. Yes.
It's, you know, funny. I was just thinking about this. So, you know, when I started at Little Brown, it felt very diverse to me. But now looking back, it's because the kind of entry level, the junior staff was very diverse. So there was actually another specifically Taiwanese American editorial assistant in my department. And at the time, the department was very small. It was like 8 people. Our marketing publicity assistant was a Korean American woman. The publisher's assistant was a Black woman. So I felt comfortable. But then when I think back and I look, it was like all the editor levels and above were all white. So unfortunately, that's still somewhat similar. I mean, I'm now like up there, but you know, again, we have a pretty diverse staff, I would say. But if you look at the kind of director level, vice president level, executive vice president level, it's not very diverse. And so, you know, this is something that I've been like talking to other publishing professionals about for 20 years. And there have been strides made. I feel like things are a little bit better, but just a little bit. They're heading in the right direction. It still has much farther to go. But again, I mean, I do think the difference I've felt, I think, in the 5 years since We Need Diverse Books was created, and then, of course, this year, even with the tragic murder of George Floyd and all of the protests that have come out of that, I do feel like it does feel different both times. And I think it's been reflected in the quality of the books that have been published in terms of, you know, I do think there are a lot of stereotypical characters, you know, that were published, you know, when I was growing up. Well, actually, when Grace and I were growing up, there were just no, you know, characters of color that we were reading, or no Asian American characters. So that has changed. I think the marketing and publicity support of these diverse books, that has improved. I have seen those books become the kind of the lead titles and the books that are getting the big marketing pushes. So that's something that I feel like has changed in the last 5 years. And then staff, you know, I think this whole pandemic and working remotely, it'll be interesting to see if that helps publishing become more diverse, because I do think geographical diversity has been one of the issues, especially because New York is super, super expensive. So we'll see. People are paying attention. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think things have improved so much over the last, you know, over the last 10 years, really, with We Need Diverse Books. That's been honestly, so my first book came out 1999, The Ugly Vegetables, and we were talking about, that's what we call diverse books, multicultural books. And I remember I would talk about multicultural books and like diversity and all these things. And I remember for about 10 years, I felt like after 10 years, I was like, I'm just talking to the same people over and over again, nothing's changed. And I kind of felt like I'll just make my books and I'll just stop talking about it. And then We Need Diverse Books came along, and also that just kind of opened the door, not wide open, but at least things were starting to open, you know? And it was a really kind of amazing thing to see things actually start to change. And it's been wonderful to see things kind of change, especially when you've been around for so long, and you've seen it not change for so long. But even as it changes, you realize how much more we have to go, you know, like, because we were talking about when we were kids, there was no Asian characters in books. And there's like one book that Alvina and I really bonded over was this series called The Cheerleaders. And neither of us liked cheerleading, but there was one Asian cheerleader. And that's why we like loved the book so much, because we're like, oh, there's an Asian cheerleader. And
her name was Hope.
Her name was Hope. She played the violin while like the other members of the team like had romances with the basketball captain. Like her drama was like she lost her violin sheet music, but it was so terrible. What do you think
she
about
got some
it?
Better but, plots later on
later. But I remember just but being just so happy like that she was there, like it didn't matter. And like but now like now we're actually starting to see books that can actually not just be superficial, but be deeper. And that's been such an important thing.
Yeah, and different genres too. You know, I think the fact, well, even Grace, you're, you know, we're in the Mount Meets the Moon, like writing a fantasy, you know, with Asian characters.
That's one of the big reasons why I wrote A Big Moon Cake for Little Star, because I really wanted to do a book that, because, you know, for a while I was doing Where the Mount Meets the Moon and Star of the Sky, which are very much based in Chinese folklore. And I kind of wanted to do something that was more Asian American with the emphasis on American and less on the Asian. So, because it seems very important to me.
Mm-hmm. And I know Alvina and I both work at publishing houses, so we can see some of the sales numbers and such. And what I find heartening is what books are selling, and more and more diverse books are selling, and that speaks loud because readers want it. The Librarian Awards, all the awards are going to books that represent diversity. So that's also, it's all kind of comes together in so many ways. And I remember growing up, I didn't see any queer characters in the books. I didn't see myself in any of the books either. So more and more that's changing, but as you both have said, we need so much more of that. And so I'm gonna switch to something that I think a lot of our listeners and viewers might be thinking about for their, as we all kind of do in this business. My laptop is shaking because my cat is bumping my table. Anyway, Sarah from also Planet Earth, we hope, is writing.
Why do we hope?
from the planet Hoth.
I kind of hope she's with that.
On the topic of imposter syndrome, how do you overcome feelings of doubt and self-criticism, if any, when you are writing and or illustrating? And I'll expand that too for you, Elton.
You know, I don't think you ever get rid of it. Honestly, I think you just have to, at least, you know, I'll just speak from my experience. I don't think you ever get rid of it. For me, I don't think I'll ever get rid of it. It's kind of become this thing where I've just accepted it as part of me, like having black hair or like having a scar, you know, or a gaping wound. Like it's kind of one of those things that I realize like I'm never, this sounds really depressing, but it's not. It's like, I feel like I'm never going to be good enough, and I'm never going to make something, and I'm never going to feel real enough, but I can't let that stop me from making what I need to make. Like, maybe the world doesn't need my art, but I need to make my art, and that's where I come from.
Right, and I think, you know, I said earlier that maybe it's comforting to know that, say, someone as successful as Grace Lynn still has, and maybe will always have, imposter syndrome, but maybe it's also not comforting because you're like, oh, I'm never going to feel confident. But I do think, I mean, I feel the same way. You know, like, every time I send an editorial letter, and I remember Caitlin Deloye was, although she was talking more about, like, not wanting to, like, give pain upon the author, but I still have imposter syndrome in terms of like when I send edits, because I think, wait, I remember there was one that I did during the pandemic, and I was like, I don't know if it's this pandemic, but I don't have too many comments on this novel, and is that just because I can't concentrate, or have I lost it, or, you know, I do think that, you know, there's a certain way where it never goes away, but the more you do it, and the you know, just, it's kind of that 10,000 hours of practice, that to become an expert. I mean, you just, the more you do it, the more comfortable you feel, and the less of an imposter you will
feel. Yeah, I think you always hear it, but it becomes easier to ignore, right, as you keep going.
Yeah, you know, so just ignore it.
I know.
They say fake it till you make it.
Continue.
I just thought, talking about the imposter syndrome and in terms of your question ahead of time, like, I think one thing that was a really big thing for me, your question about diversity, for me to get over was the idea of being like the only Asian at the house, you know, or like, and that was a really hard thing that I need to start looking at other Asians, not as competition for us fighting for one spot at a publishing house, and instead try looking at us as peers to support each other. And that's been a really, it was a really hard thing to make that switch. But once I kind of made that switch, that's been such a great thing for like that imposter syndrome and that feeling of security. Like, no, it's okay. You know, like we can help each other, not compete against each other. So.
That's wonderful. Next question is from Dee. I won't guess what planet. And for
planet
you,
Planet Alvina. That's my Twitter
handle. Alvina. I was going to say Tatooine, but so for Grace, what medium? This is from Dee. What medium do you use when you illustrate your books? And I'm expanding this because I know a lot of illustrators are listening, who work in different styles. How do you decide what style or technique, art technique, to use for a specific book? And how do you create your art?
So I am one of the few dinosaurs that does not do anything digital. that's probably why I'm really slow. I mean, I remember I finished like my last book, A Big Bed for Little Snow. I had spent a week and I posted it on Instagram, like, I finished the spread. It only took me a week, you know? And I remember Dan Santat was like, oh, I was like, I do a spread in a day. I was like, oh, okay.
Ignore him.
But his is beautiful too. But it's just, and like, it's kind of like that thing, like realizing like, oh, well, everybody just works differently, you know? But of course that first, first you're like, oh, I'm such an imposter. Like, but then you have to be like, it's okay, everyone's different. But I am one of those old dinosaurs that everything, I draw on tracing paper, and I do my changes using tracing paper, and then and I paint using watercolor paper, and I use gouache, which is a kind of thick watercolor. The one thing I do by computer is that I just started doing with A Big Moon Cake for Little Star, is that I'll scan in my drawing and then I'll have it printed on watercolor paper, so that the drawing, like before I used to take the drawing and then get transfer paper, you know, like carbon paper, like in the, like, maybe this is showing my age, but in the olden days, they used to take your credit card and then have a piece of carbon paper and like make an impression of your number. Like, so I used to use like carbon paper to like redraw onto the watercolor paper, and then I would paint it like that. But now I actually print it on the watercolor paper and it's much better. So I am very, very old school. That's probably why I am so slow. But there's a part of me that every time I start a project, I'm like, I should learn how to use the computer. I should really do it. But there's something that I love so much about sitting in front of the table and like mixing the paints. And it's such a beautiful feeling for me. Like, it really gives me that sense of calm. Like, it makes me feel like, oh, this is what I'm supposed to be doing, versus when I try, like, I do have an iPad, and I did try Procreate. Like, instead, it just kind of made me feel grumpy, like I'm staring at the screen. so like, I still have not been sold on the digital illustration yet, for me personally. However, I am sold on it for other people. They do absolutely beautiful work, and I'm like, that's amazing. So,
I have a challenge for you, which is to stop calling yourself a dinosaur. and there is no time frame for art either. You know, like, half the illustrators I work with work traditionally, half work digitally. You do you, and you do it so beautifully. So that's my personal challenge for you, is you're not a dinosaur. You create your art the way you create it.
Mm-hmm. I actually call myself traditionalist. That just sounds much better than dinosaur.
Yeah, because dinosaurs are extinct.
Yes. And there are a lot of...
Or are they?
Brand new up-and-coming illustrators who only work traditionally too. And, you know, mm-hmm. vinyl's back. So anyway, one last quick question before we wrap this up for both of you, which is something maybe that you've been asked before, that Patricia asks, is there something you know now that you wish you knew at the start of your careers?
You first.
Gosh, I know. I saw this question of like, don't ask that one because I don't know the answer. I love my job so much, and I would do my job for very little money, which is good because I did do it for very little money for so long. But something I didn't know actually, and I kind of wish I did know when I was a more junior editor, is that, you know, you can make a good living. I mean, and maybe it's because I'm at the vice president editor-in-chief level now, but I just feel really lucky that I'm doing a job that I love so much, and now I feel like finally I'm getting paid to do it. I guess earning my, I don't know, making my worth. But I think that might have helped me through the long, like it took me 10 years in publishing to stop being able to live paycheck to paycheck. You know, probably took another 5 years to get out of debt, which is typical of a lot of people. But I do, you know, I guess I just want to say, like, stick with it. If you do love this job, like, and you stay with it, and you pour your heart into it, there is some potential financial reward at the end. That sounded a little obnoxious, but that's the first thing that came into my head.
No, it's just have faith in yourself.
Yeah.
What about you, Grace?
Okay. So I'm glad you went first, because I mean, that gave me some time to think. So I would say that what I wish I knew was I could do things myself. And I'll explain what I mean. It's like, for a long time in the early part of my career, I feel like I was unhappy and complaining a lot, right? And I remember, like, I'd see, like, Daniel Handler, his publisher threw him this huge book party, and they're not doing anything for me, you know, or I'll feel like, they're doing this for somebody else, and they're not doing it for me, and like, oh, and like, and all it did to me was made me feel like, oh, you know, like, I'm not good enough, and then blah, blah, blah. And then, actually, Alvina and I talked about this on our podcast, because both of our husbands unfortunately passed away from cancer, but it took my husband passing away for me to realize I am wasting my time sitting here complaining that the publisher will not do things for me, and whining and thinking like, oh, no, you know, like, if I want a book party, I'm going to throw myself a book party. You know, if I want a bookmark, I'm going to make myself a bookmark, and I'm just going to go and get it and do what I want and not wait for somebody else to do what I want them to do for me. Like, I guess that's what it is. Like, don't wait for the publisher. Don't wait for somebody else to try to validate you and tell you that you're good enough, so they're going to throw you a party. Like, if you want a party, throw yourself a party. If you want a bookmark, make yourself a bookmark. You know, like, you can, like, I mean, like, we want a podcast. We're going to make a podcast. You know, like, I think that's the one thing that maybe that ties into the question in the very beginning about where you're like, how do you do it all? And I think how you do it all is just by doing it and not waiting for somebody else to hand it to you or give you the permission or to give it to you. You just have to do it yourself. And I think that's the best advice that I can give. And that's what I wish I had known early on. I would have saved myself a lot of wasted moments and time.
Mm-hmm. Well, that reminds me of something my mom would say when I was growing up. She would say, if it is to be, it is up to me. So, yes.
I foresee people getting that as a tattoo, perhaps.
And that's the end of our Q&A section of our SCBWI Spectacular Session.
And now we'll end, as we always do, with what we're grateful for. Grace, what are you grateful for?
Let's see. I think even though I was very frustrated with this past week, you know, I do realize that, like, I have a lot of privilege. Like, it's the truth is, like, I have the option to actually look into private school, and I actually was able to purchase a printer, you know, like, even though it put me in kind of a bad mood. Like, I am really lucky that I can do that. There's so many people who don't have that choice. So I know I need to be more grateful for that. And I am grateful, but I think I need to be more grateful. So I am grateful for that. I'm also, actually, you know what I'm also really grateful for is after we did our summer spectacular keto, it was really nice. Like, afterwards, I kept getting all these mentions and things on Twitter and like Facebook. It's like, oh, I saw it, and like, I loved it. Like, because I'm not super active on Twitter, but it was so nice to like see all these mentions of people who had watched our talk and really enjoyed it. So that really was really nice, and I'm really grateful for all the people who enjoyed our talk.
I'm really grateful for that too. You know, and what was really fun, and what I didn't actually think much about, or I just didn't think about it happening, and then when it happened, it was just such a delight, was all of the illustrators watching the conference who were sketching, you know, during our keynote, and then posting the sketches on Twitter and on Instagram. And it was just That's really true. Fun to see how we are rendered in all these different styles, you know, and also what people kind of took away from it. You know, like I did at the very end, I shared that quote that you mentioned, that my mother said, you know, all the time, if it is to be, it is up to me. And I remember Laurent was like, I can see people getting tattoos of that. But that was, you know, that, and probably also because it was at the very end, but that was like the one quote that a lot of people kind of took away from that talk. And that was really sweet. So I guess I'm grateful for my mother for saying that to me. And I will say now that I'm also grateful for these conferences to be done, because, you know, they are a lot of work. And it's also just a little bit stressful. I think this time I'm grateful that your Zoom started working, even though the sound was a little off at the beginning. Because I know, you know, we were all logging in 15 minutes before and you were texting me and saying, the Wi-Fi isn't up yet and I'm not sure. And I was like, oh no, am I going to have to like wing it or like tell some story by myself? But, you know,
And then midway through, I had to call in and do the audio by phone. So, but they were such pros at SCBWI. It's almost like they knew that was going to happen. So like, this is what you're going to do.
Yeah. They had all the backups and that was really great.
That was really cool that they were.
Them
yes, that they were such pros about it. So
yeah, great.
So,
and now here's our 2-minute book review segment featuring Allison Morris, Senior Director of Title Selection at First Book.
Hello, book friends. This week, I want to introduce you to a book that is just pure fun. And I'm also going to include a few spoilers, which I rarely do, but I think this time it will be worth it. Unstoppable, written by Adam Rex and illustrated by Laura Park, is a ridiculous picture book in which a crab and a crow each feel limited by their respective abilities, so they join forces, becoming a crab bird with crow flapping above and crab dangling below while snapping at its enemies. And they feel unstoppable. They can pinch anything, but they can't swim, which feels like a very unfortunate limitation. So they add a turtle to the mix. And now they are a flapping crow with a crab and a turtle. They are crab-ertle bird, bird-rab-ertle, crab-turd. They are unstoppable. Except they meet a bear, so they add him to the mix. And now they have this bear, bird, crab, turtle thing, a crabber, bear bird. And they really do seem to have it all. But they can't stop the developers from digging up their lakefront to build a shopping mall. So, surprise, they swoop into the Oval Office and steal the president, which I bet you didn't see coming. But she, and a woman of color at that, tells them she doesn't make the laws, Congress does. So, in the end, what we see is a giant ball of humans, that is Congress, flying through the sky, dangling under a bear, a turtle, a crab, and a flapping crow. And this Congressa Birdra Birdle bear truly is, as the title suggests, unstoppable, because it can both make laws and pinch things. The end. This book is both absurd and absurdly funny. There is technically a subtle lesson embedded here about government, about collaboration, about separation of powers, but who says that can't be fun? Not the creators of this book. Get your claws on a copy of Unstoppable, written by Adam Rex and illustrated by Laura Park. I'm Allison Morris. That's Allison L. Morris on Twitter and Kid Lit Girl on Instagram. Thank you for listening and have a great week.
Thanks for joining us, and thanks to Hachette Book Group, Hachette Audio, Little Brown Books for Young Readers, and Alex at PC Work Studio for producing and editing this podcast. You can find me at Planet Alvina on Twitter and at Alvina Ling on Instagram.
and I'm at Pacey Lynn on both platforms. We love hearing feedback, so keep tagging and messaging us on social media using the hashtag BookFriendsForever or send us a message via our website, BookFriendsForever.com. You can also see more detailed show notes there.
And if you have any suggestions for future topics to cover, please let us know. And of course, please remember to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. And if you like this podcast, please tell a friend about it. I'm Alvina Ling.
And I'm Grace Lynn.
Have a great week.
And happy reading!